right, we are in Numbers 21 this evening. We decided that since we've got lectures next week and we're trying to figure out what to do with that, we would just take tonight's song service and push it back a week, and that way we can not have a bunch of visitors come into the middle of a class and also not have to try to scramble and find someone to speak for us or for one of us to come up with something extra. So, you're stuck with me today, so I apologize for that, but we will be pressing forward. So, Numbers 21 tonight. Next week will be our song service, and then after that, like I said, for the next few classes, we'll be kind of going one at a time through the Balaam story, slowing down a little bit, and then picking our pace back up after that and wrapping up the book sometime around, I think I said the end of April or so. I don't remember what I said, so we'll finish it eventually. All right, hopefully you'll survive better than this generation of Israelites did. So, all right, let's, with that in mind, begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're thankful to you that you are indeed a God who keeps your promises. And we know that means that if we fail you by continually not being the people that you would have us to be, and turning our back on you and rejecting you and your promises, that your constancy and the sureness of you always doing what you say means that we will be judged. But that also, if we trust in you and live a life that seeks to honor you and seeks to commune with you, that we will be forgiven and blessed. And so, Father, we ask that we would have the spirit of people who desire your presence in our lives. And help us to seek to obey those things that you have laid before us, not with the thought that it would earn us any favors, but simply because you are our God and you have told us what you would have us to do. Help us tonight in our study that we would grow in it, in our knowledge of you, and our better understanding of the people that you'd have us to be. It's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen. I'll try to keep the coughing to a minimum. I'm pretty sure that I picked something up earlier this week. So I'm struggling a little bit with that, but I don't have the time to get sick this week, so I figured I'd just go on. So Numbers chapter 21, this is of course following on a chapter last time that we kind of characterized as the beginning of a new generation. It's, you know, one of those spots where you're like, well, it's not technically the end of the old generation yet. There's still some of those alive. We'll get the last of them at Baal Peor and then the new census, which is a little bit more of a marking of a true new beginning. But at the same time, I think this chapter 20 and some of the things that we saw there, and I'll come back to that in a second, in a smaller way marks a transition, and then also some of the things that we'll see in 21 mark that transition as well. Because there are things that are different in chapter 21 than what we've seen the last several chapters. There are some things that sound similar too, but there are some things that are different in 21. But in chapter 20, what we have are a couple of things that I think help mark it off as the beginning of the end, if nothing else, the beginning of this transition period from the old to the new. First of all, as we said, if you remember from last week, that Aaron's death, although the time marker is not here, later when it is recounted again, toward the end of the book of Numbers, Aaron's death happens in the 40th year since they set out from Egypt. And so that by itself is our first clue that we're kind of in this transition period. This is the end of the wilderness wandering, is the 40 years. And so they are there, they're coming back up around again to the border of the promised lands. They're right back where they were in Numbers chapter 14. So the time is up, they're back in the same geographical setting, ready to enter into the promised land. And then the other thing in chapter 20 that marks this as, again, the beginning of the, not the beginning of the end, but the beginning of this transition period, is that the entire chapter is bracketed by the death of Miriam and the death of Aaron. Moses is still around, but two of the three most significant leaders of the people are dying, or die in this chapter. So between them dying to surround the chapter, and Moses being judged that he won't enter the promised land in the middle of it, and all of this happening in the 40th year, is again telling us things are changing very quickly here at this point. And as we get into this next chapter, again, I'll come back to this in a second, but they're going to have victory here in the first three verses. And at the end of verse 3, they devote all of the things to destruction, and the name of the place was called Hormah, and that's related to the word for destruction. They're devoting it to destruction. It's the same root in the Hebrew. But this victory at Hormah is another indication that we are in a new period, a transition period, from the old generation to the new. And so as we get into chapter 21, one of the questions that I'm going to ask, and I want you to be thinking about, is we're starting to get really some of the first stories where the new generation is probably the more dominant group at this point. So many of the old generation has died at this point, and there's just a few, you know, lingering on that are going to be dying pretty soon. But probably the dominant group at this point in the book of Numbers is the new generation, the conquest generation, not the Exodus generation. And so the question I want you to be thinking about is this generation different from the old generation, or is it basically the same as the old generation, or is it a little bit more nuanced than that? And I think you see a little bit in this chapter, to give away something of an answer at the beginning, I think you see a little bit of some of the same kinds of things, and you see a little bit that's some different kinds of things, and a little that's maybe, again, a little bit harder to pin down exactly. And so we're going to work through this chapter. We're going to do something a little bit different this time. I'm not going to go in strict order through the text. I'm going to group a couple of things together because they go together conceptually. So let's start with the first three verses then. When the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction." And the Lord heeded the voice of Israel and gave over the Canaanites, and they devoted them and their cities to destruction. So the name of the place was called Hormah. So this first thing, they are, you know, again, they're making their way back to the promised land. There's a Canaanite that hears of them coming through nearby. He's a king in the Negev, which is the southern part of the promised land, kind of southern Judah, more or less. And so again, they're right there at the promised land. A Canaanite king hears of them and wants to stop them, and he goes to war against them. So this is an unprovoked attack, as far as we can tell from the text. And the Israelite reaction is this vow that if you give these people into our hand, then we'll devote these cities to destruction. Now, first of all, what does that, the latter part of this, devote the cities to destruction, what does that remind you of? And that's maybe too vague of a question. Okay, yeah. I mean, this is the basic instruction that God gives Joshua later on, right? All the cities you go, you devote them to destruction. You know, there are a few exceptions along the way, but basically you are to go into the land and destroy everything. Kill the people, destroy the cities, burn it all is basically a sacrifice to God. And what happens is they will do this. And the other piece of this that's really important for figuring out the significance of this little story, if you jump back to Numbers chapter 14 for a second, this again is where the spies have come back. They give the bad report. The people say, "We will not go into this land." God says, "I'll destroy them all." And Moses intercedes on their behalf. And God says, "You know, I'll relent. I won't destroy them all, but they're all going to die in the wilderness." And then the people say, "Oh, we don't like that either." So Moses tells the people this in verse 40 of chapter 14. They rose early in the morning and went up to the heights of the hill country, saying, "Here we are, we will go up into the place that the Lord has promised, for we have sinned." But Moses said, "Why are you now transgressing the command of the Lord? When that will not succeed, do not go up, for the Lord is not among you, lest you be struck down before your enemies. For there the Amalekites and the Canaanites are facing you, and you shall fall by the sword, because you've turned back from following the Lord. The Lord will not be with you." But they presumed to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed out of the camp. And the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them even to Hormah. So this is the one place in that defeat story, going into the promised land and they're defeated. This is the one place that is named in Numbers 14. And now they're 40 years later, they're coming back to the land, they're here at the land, the people attack them instead of them attacking the people, and they find victory at Hormah against a Canaanite king and a Canaanite army. So victory over the Canaanites, devoting a city to destruction, and victory at Hormah, where they had recently, you know, not recently, but in the book of Numbers recently, been defeated. What do you think the point of this little three-verse paragraph is?
Well, something's changed.
Something has changed. Yeah, so to our question, you know, is it the same or is it different? Well, here is, I think, some evidence that there is some definite differences going on here. A word that I think of when I read Numbers 21, 1 through 3, it's not a word that we use commonly out in the world, but it's one you'll hear around here from time to time, is the word first fruits. This is the first fruits of the Canaanite victories, or, you know, them going into Canaan and being victorious. This is God showing his people on some small level that, in fact, yes, you will take this land. And here's your first taste of it. And there's going to be more of this to come. And so it's, again, a reversal of what happened at Hormah previously. They're doing at this place the thing they will be doing, or they're supposed to be doing, in Canaan when they go into the land later. And again, it's just victory over the Canaanites. Now this devoting the city to destruction and burning everything was not the normal procedure all of the time for Israelite war. This was something that seems to be pretty restricted to the conquest of the land. And the purpose of it is to indicate that it is God who is fighting on their behalf. You know, the old saying, and this is, you know, a mentality that goes way, 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 way back, but the old saying, to the victor go the spoils. If you are the victorious general or the victorious king, you get the first choice of whatever you want of the plunder. And, well, who is winning these wars? Is it Israel or is it God? And so you devote the city to destruction, you burn everything, because that's what you're doing when you're giving an offering to God, is you burn the offering on the altar, but they're just burning this where it is in the city. And so it's a way of showing that God is the one who is behind their victory, that he is the one that is fighting on their behalf. They are giving him the spoils of his victory and his war, which also explains why it's such a big deal when an Israelite takes from that plunder and takes it back to his tent and hides it in the tent. It's not just that he took something he wasn't supposed to take. He is stealing from God. Because this belongs to God because he was victorious over this city, and it is all to go back to God. And so that's why the punishment is so severe in the Achan story later on, and why the, you know, the threat of that kind of punishment is so severe as well. So that's the first little paragraph there is the victory there at Hormah. Any thoughts or questions or comments about that? Yeah. Yeah, and so there's that difference as well, right? You know, if you do this, and this is language that doesn't sit well on American ears. It's kind of like someone's trying to bargain with God. I'll do this great thing for you, God, if you give me this thing that I want. There's no Israelite that's a faithful follower of God that would have said it at all with that tone or that intent. This is standard covenant language.
We each have a role to play in this covenant, and what I'm telling you is this is the part of the covenant that I'm taking upon myself if you will do the part that, you know, you have said that you will do. So it sounds funny to us sometimes, like someone's trying to bargain with God or, you know, finagle something out of God, but that's really not what it would ever have meant. All right, so what we're going to do now is jump to the end of the chapter and pick up in verse 25, because what I want to do for our purposes is group together the war victory stories. So here is Horma first, and there's going to be three more victories at the end of the chapter. We'll just kind of talk about all those together. Okay, Vaughn? Oh, sorry, Charlotte. Yeah. Yeah, probably, and this is the sort of thing that does happen from time to time. Whenever Numbers was written, it was known as Horma. And so it was probably in Numbers chapter 14, it's just given the name that everyone knows it as. And this is the actual origin of that name. But that's not explained anywhere, but that's my best guess as to what's going on. Everyone knows it by that, so they call it that, and now we're finding out why it's called that. Anything else? All right, so picking up in verse 21, then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside into field or vineyard. We will not drink of the water of a well. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your territory." But Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. He gathered all his people together and went out against Israel to the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from Arnon to the Jabbok as far as the Ammonites, for the border of the Ammonites was strong. And Israel took all these cities, and Israel settled in all the cities of the Amorites, and Heshbon and all its villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who fought against the former king of Moab and taken all his land out of his hand as far as Arnon. Therefore, the ballad singers say, "Come to Heshbon, let it be built, let the city of Sihon be established. For fire came out from Heshbon, flame from the city of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab and swallowed the heights of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab! You are undone, O people of Chemosh. He has made his sons fugitives and his daughters captives to an Amorite king, Sihon. So we overthrew them, Heshbon, as far as Dibon perished, and we laid waste as far as Nophah. Fire spread as far as Medeba." We're not going to get into all those details there at the end. So this is a lot like when Moses sent the letter ahead to Edom saying, "Can we pass through your land?" And Edom said no, and then they came out with the army. Same sort of thing. They need to continue on. They send requests for permission to pass through this region where Sihon is king. And he says no, and not only does he say no, he attacks. And so here's an echo of the previous generation. This time sounds pretty similar, except this time, instead of backing up and going around a different way, they excuse me, they fight back, and they are victorious in this, and they take this land, and you get a bit of a description of the land, and there's one thing I thought about sticking on a PowerPoint and bringing, and I forgot to get around to it, as a map. This is all Transjordan is where this is. This is where those three tribes are going to be later on after they divide up the land, or two and a half tribes, I guess, is what it is technically. And so, again, there's something important going on here. They are being victorious in these wars when they're attacked. They're fighting wars that, you know, I don't want to make this point too strong, but one way of possibly looking at this is they're fighting wars their parents would have run from. And they're being victorious in that, and they are beginning to accumulate some of the land that is going to ultimately be part of Israel. In its broadest sense, it's, you know, east side of Jordan, Israel, but that is going to be part of their territory that God allows them to take. And so again, you're starting to get some foreshadowing of what is to come. You're starting to see this new generation have some victories and begin to start to, you know, accomplish some of these things that these people are supposed to be accomplishing. So that's the very brief summation of it. The other piece of this that is interesting is verse 26 and then the song that follows. In some of your translations, depending on what you're reading from, this and earlier on, these poetic sections are different from translation to translation. And that's because the Hebrew is really, really difficult. And so people try to figure out what words need to be supplied because the poetry is really compact sometimes. Or if in the process of copying, words have been corrupted and what words need to be changed to make it make sense. So translations are different in these poems. But what's significant in all of this is, so they take Heshbon from Sihon, but Sihon had fought against the former king of Moab and taken all of his land out of his hand. And so Sihon had been victorious over Moab. And that leads to this song. And notice, you know, Sihon is successful over Moab in the first couple of verses there. And then verse 29, woe to you, O Moab. You are undone, O people of Chemosh. That's one of the gods of the Moabites. And the point is pretty simple, really. Sihon was stronger than Moab. And Israel was stronger than Sihon. So Moab, there's bad news for you. And that's significant because chapter 22 begins, then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was in great dread of the people. You know, why is Balak so intent on getting Balaam to prophesy against the people of Israel? Because he's terrified. Why is he terrified? Because these guys just came into town and just utterly annihilated the people that beat us. We don't want to fight them. And so this little, that's almost an oddity here at the end of the Sihon story. Why is this here? Well, the reason this is here is because it tells us the motivation of Balak. And it kind of helps give us some framework to the story that's going to follow here in a little while. All right, anything else about the Sihon story? I know that I didn't talk about a ton of details there, but... All right, so after that, then, verse 31, thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites, and Moses sent out to spy Jazer, and they captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. And so you've got another quick little story here of victory. But it's an interesting one. I think it's an important one, too, because they're spying out the land that they're about to go into. Like the earlier generation or different from the earlier generation? They're spying out the land. You're thinking, oh boy, here we go again, right? But not this time. This time it is different than the earlier generation. They spy out the land and then they go into it and take it. They take its cities and villages and dispossess the Amorites who are there. Then they turn and went up, by the way, to Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, came out against them. He and all his people to battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand, all his people to and his land. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon. So they defeated him and his sons and all his people until he had no survivor left, and they possessed his land. And so, again, it's the same basic thing. They move up into Bashan, where Og is. Og attacks. They are victorious. This time God specifically tells them they will be victorious, and they trust in God, and they are victorious. And this is extremely significant. All of this is extremely significant. Not just because it gives us the backdrop of Balak's concerns we talked about already, but because these victories are significant in the history of the people of Israel. Again, these are the first fruits of their victories over Canaan. And in Deuteronomy 1, 2, 3, 4, 29, and 31, victories over Sihon and Og are talked about. In Joshua 2, victories over Sihon and Og are talked about. In 1 Kings 4 and Nehemiah 9, victories over Sihon and Og are talked about. And in Psalms 135 and 136, victories over Sihon and Og are talked about. You're not talking about something for hundreds of years after the fact if it's not a big deal. And whether it's a big deal because this is a major victory over a stronger power and they really were that great, it was such a big deal to beat these guys, or if it's that big of a deal because of this, the symbolism, because these are the first victories. This is the beginning of the conquest. This is the beginning of the victories of the new generation and the fulfillment of the promises of God. Either way, or maybe both at the same time, these are incredibly significant moments in the history of Israel. And so when you look at just these war stories here, you say this generation versus the last generation, big difference. They are not the same people. They don't respond to the same things in the same ways. And they are beginning to possess the promised land that their ancestors rejected. Very big difference. So then let's jump back to verse 4. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way to the Red Sea. So they've been rebuffed from going into Edom, so now they have to backtrack a little bit to go around. So they're not actually going to the Red Sea, but they have to go in that direction for a little while. They go back to the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient on the way, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this worthless food." Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many of the people of Israel died. And the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people, and the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten, when he sees it, shall live." So Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a pole. And if a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. So, impatient and complaining. Complaining about the food, complaining about the drink, complaining about being taken out of Egypt to die in the wilderness. You know, they don't come right out and say it, but you almost expect them to say, "Oh, it would be better for us to go back." Are they the same or are they different? You know, if this story didn't happen in the midst of all of the success and beginning to take the promised land, you'd just say, "Oh, it's just the old guys again." But I think what we're seeing is there's still a little bit, maybe some of this is being led by the old generation. Maybe there's some of the spirit of that in a few of the younger people. Again, we're not told exactly what's going on. But in the midst of the rest of these stories about their success, it sure seems like this new generation, at least some of them, have a very similar kind of problem. But notice there is a difference in them. And it's a really important difference. You go through the book of Numbers, in Exodus before that, when you're dealing with the Exodus generation, the complaining that they do and the judgment that God brings, Moses over and over and over intercedes for the people. But unless I'm mistaken, this is the very first time that the people go to Moses and say, "Please intercede for us." Moses is doing it before now because he knows they need it, and they're too obstinate to know that they need it. They're so bent on their rebellion that they don't even realize how grave the danger is. And Moses is taking the initiative to intercede when they don't really seem to care whether he intercedes or not. This group of people, however, they make the same mistake. You know, you see, it's not that they make a mistake that's the problem. I mean, well, that is a problem, of course. Let me maybe start that sentence again. You know, that they make a mistake doesn't mean they're just like everyone else who's ever made a mistake. Their response is so drastically different that it tells us, again, yeah, it might look the same on one level, but there's a really important difference between these Israelites and the Israelites that we've seen in Exodus and Numbers up to this point. So why they say that, of course, is God sends these serpents in among them. They're called fiery serpents, and nobody knows exactly what that means. Most people presume it does not mean that they are like literally burning snakes or something like that, but either has to do with their coloring, making them look like fire, or the wounds that they cause being a really bright red that would remind people of fire, or the burning of the bite. And people have suggested all sorts of different things. But I don't think I've ever seen anyone, well, I'm sure somebody has at some point, think that they're like literally fiery serpents, you know, flying around on fire, and that makes them extra scary or something. But one of the really interesting things, and I don't know how much to make of this. I'll put this out there for you to reflect on and think about. I'm just not sure if this is something that's part of this or not. But it is striking that they, as they backtrack, of all the ways to say that they have to backtrack a little bit, it says they're going toward the Red Sea. They're going back to Egypt. And what they say is, why do we get brought up out of Egypt? And there's that kind of longing to go back, right? And then you add to that the fact that in Egypt, serpents were symbols of power and sovereignty. You think of the Pharaoh's serpent on his headdress, for example. And other Egyptian art where serpents are prominent as something related to the king or related to power or something along those lines. And it may be, for what it's worth, that God says, you want Egypt? Here's Egypt for you. This is what you're missing. And the reason, you know, why does God send serpents? Why doesn't he open the ground and swallow them? Why doesn't he send a plague? Why doesn't he send a hailstorm? Why doesn't he send any number of things? Why serpents? And it might have something to do with this longing for Egypt. Here's a taste of Egypt for you, and you'll find that it's really not to your liking. And so that may be part of the reason why God sends serpents. Of course, we're never told. But after God sends serpents, he sends salvation as well. The people ask for Moses to intercede. Moses does intercede, and he says, all right, make another serpent and stick it on a pole. And everyone who looks at that will be saved. And you think, okay, that's not normal. That's, if anything, it almost sounds a little idolatrous. An image of an animal on a pole that everyone looks at for their salvation. I mean, what would Isaiah say? And yet, that's what God tells them to do. Why this means of salvation? And again, we're not told all the details, but I think this does, at least conceptually, match with the way that the sacrificial system and ritual purification worked. By taking something that means one thing and inverting that meaning to something else. So, for example, you have sinned, and so you are going to die. Well, an animal dies so that you can live. If someone spills another person's blood, that blood pollutes the ground and calls out for justice. But that same blood, or not that same blood, but blood that you know, pollutes the ground, also is used to sanctify and to purify. We just talked in last class about the ashes of the dead cow, which would make someone unclean to handle that dead cow and deal with all of that. The ashes of this dead cow purify the one that's made unclean, who had been made unclean by coming to contact with the dead. And so constantly through the sacrificial system and ritual purifying, what you have are substances and actions that are normally polluting that serve the opposite purpose. Why? Because God said so. I don't know why. But that's what's constantly happening. And so here, you've got a case where people are dying because they've been bitten by a living snake, and they're being called upon to look at this non-living snake to find life instead of death. And so, you know, I don't know if that's the full reason of everything that's going on, but it is striking that constantly you have this kind of inverting of what you can expect something to do and it does the opposite instead. And this, at least in some small way, fits that same pattern. Now, with sacrifices and ritual purification, it requires contact of some kind. You know, the blood has to be sprinkled on you or on something. The water for the ashes has to be sprinkled on you. This time it's visual contact instead of physical contact. You have to look at this serpent. But it is still some sort of connection between yourself and this thing that is, for whatever reason, the instrument of salvation. And then finally, I'll say about this and then we'll see what other people have to say about it. The end of the story is not here, because this bronze serpent is kept and... sorry. Ultimately, by the time of Hezekiah, they are worshiping it as an idol. And so Hezekiah will destroy it along with the other things that he is cleansing the land of. But that's not the end of the story either, because Jesus will say to Nicodemus, like Moses lifted up the serpent, so also I will be lifted up. And this becomes a foreshadowing of Jesus in some way. All right, any questions or comments, please?
It's almost like, you know, God uses death to put to death, you know,
right.
Frees from it. So, going back to your point about fiery serpents, you know, what's intriguing about the Egyptian connection, you do have this constant one in Egypt, you know, like you said. And it does seem to me it's almost like, you want Egypt? I'll give you Egypt. You know, just like, you want to die in the wilderness? I'll give you dying in the wilderness, you know. And, serpent, particularly a cobra, wasn't just a sign of Pharaoh's power. It was the sign of Pharaoh's power, because it's the one that was right on his forehead.
Right.
And they, I mean, all these texts that talk about Pharaoh's power, it's called the fiery serpent. So, you know, it's hard not to see that kind of as a reflecting that.
What else? Anything else?
This just seems so. So on the one hand, you know, you think, well, this seems sort of strange. Why would God ask people to do this? But it seems like one of those things where if you had been there and you looked at the serpent, well, hopefully you would recognize, okay, it's not that thing that did anything. It's not
right. Yeah, and you think, you know, God inverting something from what it originally signified to something else, you know, serpent on the staff to the cross, Satan is the origin of all death, to Jesus as the solution to all of it. It's all that very well also.
You know, what seems like here is you have an image, you know, you have this prohibition against image making. But what's true or not, their experience with idolatry is you bow down and worship and offer sacrifice to this image.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that going on. It's just look at the image. And, it's interesting because it's like, wow, why not make an image of a mongoose, you know, that is a natural enemy of, you know, cobras and would defeat them and kill them. And, oh, you know, our mongoose is our salvation. But it's you can't help but be reminded when you look at it, oh, yeah, it's the snakes because, you know, we sinned and we rebelled against God. And it's the same thing when you look at the cross, you see the price of the cost of our sin.
Yeah.
And it's a reminder of our, you know, we're the ones that put him there.
Yeah, and it reminds me, it's not the same thing at all. It reminds me a little bit of back in chapter 16 when Aaron, you know, takes his censer and runs out into the midst of the plague, and, you know, he's the firewall, so to speak. The plague stops where Aaron is. And there's nothing special about that other than God is using that. The same thing is here. It's not a line. The line is whether you look at it or not. And everyone that looked at it, they were protected, and everyone that didn't, they weren't. And, you know, this is more of the killing of the old generation and perhaps a little culling of the new generation. Those of the next generation that were in the mindset of their fathers may well be dying here and in the next scene as well. We don't know with detail, you know, precise detail, who died and who didn't in these kinds of things.
Well, that's true. You don't know whether these snakes were being indiscriminate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a judgment of God. They could have been sent specifically to, you know, the leaders or those that were quickly called. And so they are going to be killed off, or if they were among those but they repent, then they can be spared. But, you know, if you picture all this 4-year-old Johnny over here, he's a 4-year-old that doesn't obey that well. Look at the snake, son! Yay! Oh, kid died. I don't know. It's quite like that. Of course, we don't know.
Right. All right. Let's talk briefly here about the last chunk of the text, which is verses 10 through 20. We don't have a lot of time, but I didn't expect to spend a lot of time here. They're basically continuing their journey. Notice verse 10, the people of Israel set out and camped in Oboth. And then they set out from Oboth and camped at Abarim, in the wilderness that is opposite Moab toward the sunrise. From there they set out and camped in the valley of Zered. From there they set out and camped on the other side of Arnon. It will continue on, and you have these sayings from the Book of the Wars in verse 14. They sang a song in verse 17 as they continued on to Be'er, which is, it's just the word for well. There. And then down in verse 18, from the wilderness they went on to Matanah, and from Matanah to Nahaliel to Bemoth, from Bemoth to the valley lying in the region of Moab by the top of Pisgah that looks down on the desert. Now you see why I didn't plan on spending a lot of time there. What do you have here? What you have is moving through the wilderness. The people are journeying. To and through a whole bunch of places we have no idea where they are. Which is, again, another spot where it's kind of like, yep, this reminds me of the old generation, just moving through the wilderness. But this time there's a difference. This time they're proceeding with purpose. And this time their journeys are punctuated with these songs and this apparent joy and this expectation of what lies ahead. And so, yeah, there are echoes of the Exodus generation and the moving through the wilderness, but it's not exactly the same thing. There's a difference. And so that's what I think we're beginning to see here in chapter 21. Chapter 20 marks something of the end of that first generation. They're not all gone. There's more of that story to be told still. But we're beginning to see something new. They're victorious in the war. They're beginning to defeat the Canaanites. They are beginning to possess parts of the promised land. They sin, but they seek Moses' intercession this time. They journey and they journey and they journey, but there's hope and expectation and singing in their journeying. And so, yeah, it's a lot new. There are a few echoes of the old, but even when those show up, there's something different about it now than in the group we've seen from Mount Sinai to Kadesh and through the wilderness for the 40 years after that. And just like Numbers does, you say, aha, things are better now. And then the other shoe falls. And it won't be that long before we find them at Baal Peor and the rest of that first generation dying at that point and that great sin that will happen there. But we got a little while before we get to that point. So any last questions or comments today? Thoughts? Yeah, Tom?
You mentioned Baal Peor. That's another one of those comparisons. Baal Peor sounds very much like the Golden Calf episode in Exodus 32. But, again, they deal with it. You know, they have people who are willing to stand up and, you know, do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what was missing.
Right.
And also this thing about water. You know, they were complaining and they didn't have any water. And it's obvious they didn't have any water. On this occasion, where God said, I'll show you where to dig, and, you know, X marks the spot, and they dug it, and they were happy to do so, and joyfully praised the water.
Any last thoughts? All right, well, we'll have our singing next week, and be in Numbers 22 after that.